Okay, so today we're going to be talking about quantity, the metaphysics of quantity. So quantitative properties are properties like mass and charge that come in degrees, and we measure with numbers. So we talk both about particular values of a quantity using numbers, as when we say that something is 5 grams mass, but also we use numbers to state laws about quantities. So the question, metaphysical question is, what's metaphysically up with that? What is the underlying metaphysics of quantity? What is it about a quantity, a property like mass, that justifies us in using numbers to talk about it and state laws about it? So the most flat-footed approach to the metaphysics of mass is a kind of Pythagorean approach where we involve numbers in the facts about mass. And we say that a quantitative theory about mass, is a theory about a relation like the mass in grams relation. The mass in grams relation is a relation between concrete things like me and real numbers. So an object bears the mass in grams relation to the real number that gives its mass in grams. And if you were thinking in terms of modal and ontological metaphysical tools, you've looked at the question of quantity through that lens, that might look all right. I mean, there would be a question of whether you really believe that there exist real numbers. But if you did believe there exist real numbers, what's the problem? I mean, you might supplement that this way of talking about mass with some necessary truths correlating relations corresponding to different scales. So you would say it's a necessary truth that if something bears the mass in grams, say the mass in kilograms relation to a certain number, that it bears the mass in grams relation to 1,000 times that number. You could recognize necessary truths connecting these relations to numbers to certain non-numerical concepts. Like you might say it's a necessary truth that if two objects bear the mass in kilograms relation to two numbers, then the one number is a bigger number than the other if and only if the first object is more massive than the second, for example. So you could, when supplemented with necessary truths like that, if you believed in the existence of numbers, that all might look fine. But when you view the problem through the lens of fundamentality, and that's the way I'm going to be viewing the problem for the rest of today, when you view the problem through the lens of fundamentality, then some new questions come into view, and things aren't so simple. So you should ask the question, well, which of these numbers is the fundamental relation? Mass. So are you going to say that the mass and kilograms relation between concrete objects and real numbers is the fundamental mass relation? That seems crazy. That would be to privilege the kilograms unit over other units. Surely no one unit is metaphysically privileged in that. So would you instead say, okay, well then I don't want to privilege any one unit, so all of the relations corresponding to mass in unit U for every unit, all those relations are fundamental. Well, that seems like overkill. I mean, that seems like you've got now massive redundancy in the set of fundamental properties. So this dilemma of arbitrarily privileging a unit on one hand and redundancy in the others seems to suggest we should move away from this this flat-footed metaphysics. But then what? Well, let's now consider what I call in the handout simple absolutism. So this is the view that the fundamental mass properties and relations are just the determinate masses, and similarly for other quantities. So by a determinate mass, I mean the property of having exactly such and such a mass. So the property of having exactly this mass, and having exactly this mass, and having exactly that mass. Those are the fundamental mass properties. And similarly for every other property, every other quantitative property. So these determinate mass properties, the property of having such and such mass, we normally name those using numbers. We might name one of those as the property of having exactly 56 kilograms mass. But the idea is the numbers are not to be thought of as built into these properties. You've just got this continuum, many marbles, the various mass properties, and each one is a fundamental property, and there's nothing about numbers that's built into any of these properties. So it moves away from privileging a unit because no particular number is associated with any one of these properties. It moves away from redundancy, but it moves too far away from numbers in that intuitively, nothing in this metaphysics justifies the practice of using numbers to measure mass or any other quantity. There's no basis for numerical representation in this metaphysics. We'll sharpen that in a bit. So let's look at another account where there is a basis, as we'll see, for numerical representation. That's going to be the main, and this metaphysics is going to be the main topic of discussion today, which, by the way, is going to be, I should warn you in advance, much less conclusive than the other lectures. This metaphysics is comparativism. So the intuitive idea of comparativism is that individual mass values are secondary and mass comparisons are primary. Comparisons like this thing has more mass than that, or this thing has twice as much mass as that. So here are a couple of relations that the comparativist that I have in mind is going to privilege. So one is the, actually, what did I say in the handout? As or more massive than, we say X is as or more massive than Y. The idea for the comparativist I have in mind is that this is a fundamental mass relation. It's important that this relationship of X being as or more massive than Y, not be understood as relying on an underlying numerical scale. You can get your handle on which relation it is by thinking about scales. So if X is 5, by thinking about numerical scales, so if X is 5 grams and Y is 4 grams, then X is as or more massive than Y. But the idea is that this is a fundamental relation. It's not defined in terms of anything about numbers. In fact, the reverse, as we'll see, the practice of using numbers to represent mass derives from relations like this. So that's one relation, and another is a relationship of concatenation. So X and Y concatenate to Z means that X and Y together in mass equal Z's mass. And again, this is not to be understood as being understood via underlying numerical scales. It's a direct physical relation you could test by, for example, sticking X and Y on one side of a pan balance and Z on the other, seeing if they balance. As long as X and Y, none of those overlap with each other, that'll work. And the pan balance is working. So the idea then for one kind of comparativism says the fundamental mass relations are just these two. And similar story then can be told for other quantities. So you can think of the move from one of those Pythagorean views where you said that there was one privileged relation to numbers that gave the fundamental mass facts. You can think of the move between from that view to this view as a move in the direction of structuralism. Because think of the mass facts for that Pythagorean flat-footed view. The mass facts consist of an array of numbers representing masses distributed over all the objects. And the structuralist thought is, well, there's too much structure in this array because the individual numbers are not significant to physics. All that's significant to physics is relationships amongst the numbers. So we need to move to a metaphysics that takes the pattern seriously, but not the individual nodes in the pattern seriously, the individual numbers. Comparativism is such an account. Now, also, comparativism, though, isn't metaphysically suspect in the way that some of the other forms of structuralism that I've been talking about in these lectures is metaphysically suspect. It doesn't require any funny business like ungrounded existential statements or it isn't that it can only be stated using essence theoretic vocabulary where there is a sense that we don't have enough of an explanation of what's going on. There's nothing like patterns without objects in the patterns. The comparativist account is a perfectly straightforward account that tells us what the particular fundamental properties and relations are having to do with mass. The reason that there's no funny business about ungrounded existentials or relations without relata is that the comparativist doesn't, when the comparativist moves from one kind of network where you have those numbers to another network where you just have relations, The objects that the relations are relating are not understood in any structuralist way. The objects that these relations relate are just physical objects. So it's metaphysically very straightforward. So now, in what sense can the comparativist justify the use of numbers to measure maps? Well, via representation and uniqueness theorems that are familiar from the theory of measurement. So a representation function is a function that assigns real numbers to the objects that are in the field of relations like these in a way that meshes with these relations. So a representation function for mass should have this feature. The mass of one, it should be a function that assigns real numbers to objects, and it should assign a number that is greater than or equal, assign a number to x that is greater than or equal to what it assigns to y, if and only if the object x is as or more massive than the object y. And there should also be a constraint relating this to the function. The number it should assign to z should be the sum of what it assigns to x and what it assigns to y, if and only if this relation holds between x, y, and z. So a representation function for mass is a function from massive objects to real numbers that codes up in this way the facts about these comparativist predicates. What a representation theorem says is that there exists at least one such function. And what a uniqueness theorem says is that any two functions of this sort will differ only in a way that corresponds to an arbitrary choice of unit. So uniqueness theorem for these mass functions will say that if you have any two functions satisfying the two constraints I mentioned, then one of them is going to be a scalar multiple of the other. That is, the values of one will be the result of taking some one constant positive real number and multiplying it by the values of another. Okay? So, given certain assumptions about how these relationships behave, given certain axioms on these relations, one can then prove representation and uniqueness theorems, and it's via, and so we'll know that there exist these numerical representations, and it's because of this that you have a justification of the practice of measuring mass and other quantities by numbers in the fundamental account of what mass is. The fundamental relations of mass play a role in these representation theorems and uniqueness theorems. So, whereas for absolutism, nothing like a representation theorem can be proven because the absolutist doesn't recognize anything like these structuring relationships. It just has an unstructured set of mass properties. So we're refining a little more this idea that simple absolutism cannot, but comparativism can, justify the practice of using numbers to measure. Now, let's move on, though, because there's more to be said about all this. So I want to first say something a little more satisfying about what's inadequate about simple absolutism. And most of the rest of what I'm going to say today has to do with the connection between the metaphysics of quantity and laws. So let's start by thinking about what would laws look like for a simple absolutist. So simple absolutism, remember, says the only fundamental mass properties are, or relations, are these determinate properties of having exactly such and such a mass that don't have any numbers built in. So the only laws one could state using properties just of that sort, both for quantity like mass and also for other quantities, would have the following form. So let's imagine what a law like Newton's second law would look like, F equals ma, but pretending that, so F equals ma for a simple absolutist would have to look something like this. It would say, if a particle has exactly this mass and is undergoing exactly this net force, then it will undergo exactly this acceleration. But if on the other hand it has a different mass and is undergoing exactly such and such a net force, then it will undergo a correspondingly different acceleration. And if it has yet another mass and is undergoing another force and so forth. It would have to be this infinitary thing specifying one by one all the combinations of forces and masses and resultant accelerations.
Because there's no other resources available to state fundamental laws using the fundamental properties of that theory.
So if one a part of one's epistemology of fundamentality is what I mentioned in the first day when I read that quotation from Frank's book, where I said one of the main constraints on choosing a set of fundamental properties and relations is that those properties and relations ought to enable simple and strong laws, simple when evaluated by their statement in terms of the fundamental properties and relations, then that epistemology should lead us to reject simple absolutism, because simple absolutism doesn't enable simple laws. Whereas you'd expect, given the possibility of representation theorems and uniqueness theorems being proven on the basis of the properties and relations recognized as fundamental by comparativism, you might expect there to be simple laws on that side. So the real problem with simple absolutism, the sharpest problem, is that it doesn't enable simple, strong laws, whereas you might expect comparativism to enable simple and strong laws because of the fact that you can prove representation theorems and uniqueness theorems on the basis of its fundamental concepts. But let's look more. Let's look more closely at laws and comparisons. So there's a commonly recognized problem or obstacle for comparativism, which is that comparativists need to make strong existence assumptions. So what I have in mind is on the handout, on listed as existence of sums and density. So these are a couple of assumptions, strong assumptions about what objects in the field of these relations exist. And they each imply that there exist infinitely many objects. So, the existence of sums says that take for any x and y, there is a z such that x concatenated with y gives z. So, for any two objects, there's another object whose sum is the sum of the masses of the first two. And density says that strictly intermediate between any two objects, there's another object, intermediate in mass between the first two, provided that the first two don't have the same mass of each other. So comparativists, to make the theory work out, normally make assumptions like these, like one or the other, or sometimes both. And there's a question of whether those assumptions are correct. I mean, if there are only finitely many massive things, then those assumptions aren't going to be correct. And there's a long discussion we could have about whether versions of these assumptions are appropriate in certain settings, but I want to not talk about that kind of issue. What I want to focus on is what goes wrong if those assumptions are false. So if we look at things from a fundamentality theoretic perspective, what is the underlying problem if those existence assumptions are false? So the problem isn't with the representation theorem, because the representation theorem just says, the representation theorem says there is at least one measurement function satisfying the constraints. And the representation theorem is going to hold even if the existence assumptions don't hold, provided the actual structure of objects standing in these relations is embeddable in a richer structure obeying the existence assumption. So the representation theorem isn't what's threatened. What's threatened is the uniqueness theorem. So if the uniqueness theorem, if there aren't, if density, if assumptions like density and existence of sums fail, there won't be enough objects to uniquely constrain measurement functions up to an arbitrary explosive unit. So it might be that there are two ways of assigning numbers to objects, each of which meshes with the comparative, its fundamental facts, but one of them isn't the result of, one of them's values aren't the result of taking the other's values and multiplying by a constant. So why is that bad, though? I mean, you can imagine a comparativist responding and saying, well, in a rich world like ours, where there are lots of objects, the divergences between different acceptable mass functions are going to be small. So it's not going to threaten our use of numbers in practice to measure mass. So what's the problem? Well, I think the problem ultimately has to do with laws. So let's start thinking about what the comparativist laws look like. We saw that the simple absolutist isn't going to have any simple laws. What's the comparativist law? What are the comparativist laws going to look like?
So let's think about a simple, oversimplified case. Again, Newton's second law,
where we pretend now that acceleration and force don't have directions. We're pretending they're just scalar quantities, so we can not worry about lots of details. So here's one form that a comparativist law might take. This is on the handout as well. There exist representation functions for force, mass, and acceleration. F, M, and A, such that for any x, the value of the force function is equal to the product of the mass function and the acceleration function's values for that object.
So this is the kind of law that a comparativist could state. There exists at least one representation function obeying Newton's second law, formulated numerically. So this could be true, given the failure of the uniqueness theory. But it won't be unique. That is, even if there are representation functions obeying Newton's second law in numerical form, there might also be other representation functions that don't obey that numerical relationship. So what's the problem with that? You might think the problem with that has to do with determinism. You might think that this threatens to make determinism false, even in worlds that you would have expected it to be true. And before we evaluate whether that's really a problem and see whether the comparativist would have a comeback, we got to evaluate a more basic threat to determinism that comes from comparativism. So a typical statement of determinism says this: a world is deterministic if an intrinsic description of one time, together with the world's laws, implies an intrinsic description of any other time or any future time. The problem is, for a comparativist, an intrinsic description of a time is going to be way too thin to give that form of determinism a fighting chance to be true, because a comparativist's intrinsic description of a time is only going to include relationships, quantitative relationships, between the objects existing at that time. So it won't include, for example, mass relationships between objects at that time and any other time. So what you normally think of as the mass of a thing for a comparativist is going to be constituted by its mass relationships to objects at every other time. So it's that kind of determinism, that statement of determinism threatens to be false simply because comparativism is true, whether or not the existence assumptions hold. A more comparativist-friendly statement of determinism would be something like this. It would go via representation functions. It would say, choose any representation functions and describe what the world is like at a time using those representation functions. Then apply the laws. That will then imply a description of any later time using those same representation functions. So this is, I hope that's intuitive, just put that way. Up on the handout, I've got down a comparativist determinism that says that.
The idea is you take any representation functions, describe the world at a time with those functions. The laws then will tell you what the description is like in terms of those functions at later times. That lets the description of a time code up stuff about all times. So by the way, it makes the prediction of future times as a function of past times highly non-local. For the comparativist in a striking way. But in any case, that's the sort of comparativism that has determinism that has a fighting chance of being true for a comparativist. But now you see there is a threat to determinism from the non-uniqueness of laws of this sort. Because simply the mere fact that one representation function obeys a simple numeric law like this, which would deterministically, together with other numerical laws, predict world states' descriptions in terms of that representation function. It doesn't follow that for any representation function you chose to describe a world state at a certain time, there would then be, predicted by the laws, a description of future states in terms of that representation function. So that statement of determinism is threatened by the non-uniqueness of laws of this sort. But even that, I'm not sure, really gets to the threat posed by the failure of the uniqueness assumptions, because I wonder whether a determinist, a comparativist, could say with some plausibility that we should privilege, in our conception of what world states are like and in our conception of what the laws are like, representation functions that as a group stand in simple numerical laws. And so they could say the right way to understand what world states are like and what determinism is that determinism says that for any simple numerical representation functions, by which I mean representation functions that stand in simple numerical relationships, a description of the world state at one time in terms of those functions implies, plus by together with the laws, a description of subsequent times in terms of those representation functions. So the comparativist, that is, could let the laws intrude on the descriptions of individual world states in an unexpected way, because the privileged descriptions of world states would be given by representation functions that obey simple laws. So I'm not yet sure that we're at the bottom of the problem that would result if the uniqueness, if the existence assumptions and therefore the uniqueness theorem fail. What I think is the problem, or at least I thought it until I thought this until I encountered some of the problems, some of the skeptical problems I'm going to close this talk with. But what the problem is, I think, or thought, is that there won't be intrinsic laws governing the fundamental relations if the existence assumptions fail. So the problem is that there won't be intrinsic laws in Hartree field sets. So let me talk about that. So the kinds of laws we've been talking about, laws like this, are constraints on the fundamental predicates of greater than or equal to in mass and mass concatenation and other similar relations for other quantities, for force and acceleration and so forth. They are constraints in those quantities, but they're very indirect in an unsatisfying way. What the laws like this say is that those relationships are such as to, those relationships can be coded up with these other things, these numerical functions. And the numerical functions satisfy simple laws. But wouldn't it be more satisfying to have a direct constraint on how these predicates behave, rather than an indirect constraint via the representation functions? Field says that even if you, I mean, Field's book is ultimately a defense of nominalism, but he says even if you didn't care about nominalism, you should still like his approach, because his approach gives you intrinsic laws. You should think that intrinsic laws stated directly about the properties that are more directly connected to the metaphysics of mass, properties and relations like mass concatenation and mass greater than. You should think that constraints directly on those are the real laws. And you should seek a metaphysics of laws that enables the statement of intrinsic laws. Laws not bringing in extraneous stuff like real numbers. Axioms directly concerning the fundamental predicates. There's something very intuitive about this call for intrinsic laws. But it's not trivial to figure out what intrinsic laws might underlie an extrinsic law like this. So the search for intrinsic laws is what Frank and Kean Dorr call the hard problem of quantity, is that what you call it? And so it's a non-trivial question as to whether there exist intrinsic laws in any given case. So what I want to argue next is that if the existence assumptions fail, then there won't exist intrinsic laws in a field sort anyway. So let me look at just a bit at Field's method for producing intrinsic correlates of statements like
like this.
So Field uses a kind of standard technique from the theory of measurement called the technique of standard sequences. So a standard sequence is, well, I'm going to set it up anyway, a series of objects that are evenly spaced with respect to some quantity. So if this has some mass m in a standard sequence, then the next member of the sequence has mass 2m, this has mass 3m, this has mass 4m, and so on. So it's this infinite sequence of massive objects where adjacent members are the same, are where each one is the result of taking the previous and concatenating the first in the sequence. So you can think just intuitively, and I'm not going to lay out all the details of how this works, because that. But if you think intuitively, you can think of a mass sequence as a kind of grid where you can measure the mass of anything in the world using that grid. And not everything is going to fit exactly on the grid or at a point of a grid, so you can't think of, you know, I mean, some objects would be exactly four times the mass of the unit of the grid. Other objects won't follow exactly at a point in the grid. But by choosing grids with finer and finer resolution, you can measure more and more accurately with increasingly fine grids. And what Field does is he shows how to nominalize statements about, say, ratios between real-value quantities using quantification over standard sequences of this sort. Quantification over mass sequences, over charge sequences, over mass density sequences, acceleration sequences, and so forth. Again, ignoring the directionality in something like acceleration. So what goes wrong with this procedure if existence assumptions are false? Well, most simply, the problem is the standard sequences won't exist, because in this way of setting it up anyway, the standard sequences are infinite, and so there have to exist arbitrarily large, massive objects for the standard sequences to exist. And so if existence of sums fails, then there won't exist standard sequences, and there won't exist standard sequences of, you can't be guaranteed that you can choose sequences of arbitrarily fine grain if density doesn't hold. So why is that a problem? Well, let me just look at one case of what a Fieldian law might look like. So suppose we're talking again about F equals MA and simplify, make even more simplifications than what we've been making so far, so that we imagine that the force on every object is constant, so that the law just says that the product of mass and acceleration for any two objects is the same. So the law says for all x, mass of x times the for all x and y, the mass of x times the acceleration of x is equal to mass of y times the acceleration of y. Now, how would Field nominalize such a statement? You just got to take my word for it. It would look something like what's on the handout. So I'm calling it intrinsic law on the handout. So it's a mouthful, but only a small part of it is relevant. So I'll read it out and I'll emphasize the relevant bit. The intrinsic law says, for any objects x and y, so this is the intrinsic correlate of this statement which concerns mass and acceleration functions. The intrinsic correlate is, for any objects x and y, there do not exist a mass sequence S1 and an acceleration sequence S2 such that some stuff. And there do not exist an acceleration sequence S1 and a mass sequence S2 such that some other stuff. So a statement of that logical form is going to be true if there aren't any mass and acceleration sequences. So if the existence, so if there just don't exist mass and acceleration sequences because they don't exist arbitrarily massive things, then that kind of statement is going to be true simply for that reason. Now, why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem because it's not going to be a law. It's too weak a statement to count as a law because it doesn't have the right kind of implications. In particular, it doesn't have the kinds of implications that extrinsic laws like this have. So, for example, suppose that one object, X, is twice as massive as Y. So the concatenation relation for mass holds like this. So X is twice as massive as Y, so if you concatenate Y with Y, you get X. So suppose that's true. So an extrinsic law like this which says that there is some, there are some representation functions for force, mass, and acceleration, are going to imply, together with the fact that the forces are always constant, are going to imply that since x is twice as massive as y, that y is twice as accelerated as x, and so they're going to then, by the constraint that any acceleration function places on the acceleration concatenation relation, this is going to imply that this holds. So this plus the extrinsic law is going to imply this. But this plus the Fieldian intrinsic law won't imply this, because the Fieldian intrinsic law plus this could be true simply because of the lack of existence of mass and acceleration sequences. So the problem is not that what Field calls intrinsic laws won't be true. The problem is they won't be laws because they aren't sufficiently strong. Other laws might just be false. It depends on the exact logical form of the law. I'm not saying that this exact problem is going to recur for any sort of intrinsic statement of a law you might come up with given Field's approach. But the point is just to illustrate in one concrete case that you just won't have intrinsic laws of the kind that Field describes unless you have these existence assumptions. So let me say something else about the importance of intrinsic laws to this this question of quantities before I end with the promised depressing reflections, or depressing to me anyway. So Brent Mundy had a very... So Brent Mundy wrote a number of papers about quantity in the 80s. And he had... Actually, 80s and 90s. And he defended a bunch of different interesting views. One intriguing view he defended was a view that promised to be a kind of comparativism that did away with the need for existence assumptions. So I want to talk briefly about that. So Mundy's idea was that you replace both of these predicates with a single multigrade predicate that looks like this. A1, A2, AN are together as or more massive than B1, B2, BM, where N and M here can take on, where the idea is you can flank this predicate with arbitrary finite numbers of arguments. So it's a multigrade predicate. It doesn't have a fixed number of places on either side. So why is that useful? Well, Mundy shows how to prove a representation function, a representation theorem and uniqueness theorem based on natural-looking constraints you could lay down on how this behaves without making any existence assumptions at all. And I don't have to walk you through all the way, the whole proof of that representation theorem to get to see that how the trick works. So suppose you wanted to say that the mass of, so suppose we're talking about a mass greater than or equal to relation. Suppose you want to say in terms of Mundy's predicate, or a comparativist predicate, that a certain ratio of masses, m of x to m of y, is greater than or equal to some fraction n over m. So the way a comparativist would normally do that is the comparativist would consider some evenly spaced things, n of them, the last of which is x, and would consider m evenly spaced things, the last of which is y, and say that the first member of that sequence is as or more massive than that first member. So you would take x's mass and sort of divide it up n times, and y's mass and divide it up m times, and then say that the first thing is as or more massive than this. That's how you would say that this ratio is greater than this fraction. And that strategy, that way of nominalizing this comparison, depends on density. Because you have to know that there are these, that that the there exist massive objects of this sort, smaller than X and smaller than Y. But Mundy can do it, can make a statement like this without assuming density at all. Mundy just says something like this. You stick M occurrences of X, of the variable X, and you stick Y N times on the right-hand side of this predicate, and you say, what you're saying is that M copies of X is as or more massive than Y copies of Y, except you're not doing that via ontology, you're doing that via ideology. You're not saying that there's an object consisting of whose mass is the result of concatenating X's, of adding X's mass to itself N times. You're rather just flanking this predicate by M occurrences of the variable X and flanking the right side of it by N occurrences of the variable Y. So once you see that trick, you can kind of imagine how Mundy might be able to prove a representation theorem to the effect that there exists a unique numerical representation provided there are appropriate constraints are laid down on this predicate. It's a very neat account, but the problem is Mundy never considers the problem of stating of how intrinsic laws might be stated for this for his predicate. And this trick he uses for nominalizing comparisons of ratios is essentially tied to N and M here being constant. He can say for fixed N and M, in his terms, what it is for this ratio to exceed N and M. But when you want to nominalize real value comparisons of relations, you need to be able to quantify over N and M over there. You need to be able to say things like, for any fraction, suppose you want to say this ratio is greater than or equal to another real valued ratio. You want to be able to say, or say you want to say those ratios are equal. You want to be able to say things like, well, for any fraction, this is greater than or equal to the fraction, if and only if the other is greater than or equal to the fraction. So N and M have to be quantified there. And there's no but for field, it's straightforward to quantify, in effect, to quantify N over M in this case, because you would quantify over the kinds of sequences he would be choosing here. Because here the sequences are objects. Here the sequences aren't objects. They're just sequences of notation. So there isn't any way to extend Mundy's approach for variable N and M, and so I don't see how Mundy's approach could be extended to state intrinsic laws unless he started just bringing in standard sequences like field does, which then it reintroduces the need for the existence assumptions. Well, I want to talk next about this insistence, though, that the laws be intrinsic. So far, what we've got is an important constraint I've put forward on the fundamental properties is that they ought to be capable of stating strong, simple, intrinsic laws. The requirement that laws be intrinsic is an extra requirement. It doesn't follow from the requirement that the fundamental properties and relations be such as to state simple, strong laws. Because a law like this might be appropriately simple and strong. I mean, the laws have to be simple when formulated in terms of fundamental concepts. And so it's got to be that that the mathematical vocabulary here has to be based, I mean, you have to recognize at the fundamental level properties and relations over mathematical objects, but if you're a certain kind of Platonist, you should be happy to do that, and so you should be happy to regard this as a simple, strong statement when formulated in fundamental terms. The requirement that we don't just want simple and strong statements, but we want simple, strong, intrinsic statements is an extra requirement, and we should ask, well, what is its source? What intuitively is the basis for the requirement? What is wrong with extrinsic laws like this? And Field says a bunch of different things. So he talks about extrinsic laws bringing in causally irrelevant entities, bringing in extraneous entities, and bringing in arbitrary choices. I want to talk about each of those things. This is all from Science Without Numbers. So he says, he complains about formulations of laws that, quote, appeal to extraneous, causally irrelevant entities. And then he later expands on this idea that extrinsic laws like this would bring in causally irrelevant entities. And he says, if at first blush appears to be the case, we need to invoke some real numbers, like 6.67 times 10 to the negative 11th, the gravitational constant, in our explanation of why the moon follows the path that it does. It isn't because we think that real number plays a role as a cause of the moon's moving that way. So one concern is that we will be saying implausible things about numbers and causation if we think the fundamental laws are extrinsic. And that just seems wrong to me. I mean, saying that there are fundamental laws like this isn't going to imply that, I don't know, the fact that that number is greater than zero causes the moon to move the way it is. I mean, I can't think of any conception of what causation would be where you would have causal relationships between facts about, say, purely numerical facts and the physical facts. I can't see any conception of causation on which those facts would result from the existence of laws like this. I don't see how the fact that I am more massive than my daughter would be caused by some fact about pure numbers. So I can't see this complaint about causal relevancy as amounting to anything other than the brute insistence that the laws shouldn't involve numbers. And that just seems like a prejudice. So I don't think this first complaint, this first conception of what's wrong with extrinsic laws like this goes anywhere. The second, he also talks about the concern that numbers are extraneous entities. And I think the idea there is we have this sense that a law has a proper subject matter. And the proper subject matter of Newton's second law is bodies in motion. And it shouldn't bring in any other kinds of objects into our account of bodies in motion. Real numbers are intuitively not part of the intuitive subject matter of Newton's second laws, so they don't belong in a fundamental account of what Newton's second law is. And that, I think, I mean, that has something intuitive going for it, but, I mean, Joseph Mealy pointed out a long time ago that Field's own laws seem to sin by that same measure, because standard sequences feel extraneous to the proper content of Newton's second law. So standard sequences are made up of bodies in motion. But the sequences themselves are composed of bodies at arbitrary spatial distances from the object that whose motion you're considering at any given time. And it seems like he's kind of spatially, you know, like this could be here and this could be in another planet and this could be in the other side of the galaxy. Those kinds of objects don't feel like they're the proper subject of the laws of motion. So, we would at least need some account of what extraneousness amounts to so that that complaint could be sustained against these kinds of laws, but not against Field's kinds of laws. There's another related concern about Field's laws that's worth bringing out, although it's also a concern about this, which is related, but not exactly the same, which is that they are spatially non-local in a certain sense. So you ordinarily think of, actually for two reasons. For one thing, Field's laws are going to bring in two things at a time. They're going to, in my simplified version, where it's a nominalization of this statement, it doesn't just say for one thing what it's going to do as a function of the forces acting on it and its mass. It talks about, it mentions a comparison between two things, but also it talks about two things via quantification over mass sequences, where the objects in the mass sequences are at arbitrary spatial and temporal distances from the object in question. And something similar is true of the intrinsic law as well. So there's the law is moving a long way away from this intuitive picture of Newton's laws telling us what a particle is going to do just as a function of what's going on right around the particle. So in any case, that's the extraneous reading of the complaint about extrinsic laws. Another thing Field talks about is arbitrariness. So he says, says that one of the things that gives plausibility to the idea that extrinsic explanations are unsatisfying if taken as ultimate explanation is that the functions involved in many extrinsic explanations are so arbitrary. Now, the idea is that when you make an explanation, I guess, with a particular representation function, you've made an arbitrary choice because you've chosen a particular unit of measure when you've chosen that representation function. But laws like this, which quantify over representation functions, don't make any arbitrary choices of that sort. So it's hard to see how this could be a complaint about that kind of law. Also, I mean, another metaphysics of mass that I haven't talked about so far is yet another one that Brett Mundy considered, which is the view that the fundamental facts about mass are given by a two-place function, which take a pair of things and yield a real number, which is the ratio of their masses. And that kind of function is up to its ears in involving numbers in the metaphysics of mass, but doesn't involve any kind of arbitrariness, at least not arbitrariness of choice of a unit. Maybe there's a kind of arbitrariness there that results from arbitrariness in how real numbers are to be defined in terms of sets, ultimately, or how functions are to be defined in terms of sets. There's lots of equally good ways to define the real numbers in terms of rationals, and there's different ways to define rationals down to sets. There's different equally good ways to define what an ordered pair is. So there's all sorts of arbitrary choices made in the development of the mathematical vocabulary used to state this kind of account, or used to state the Mundian ratio view. So perhaps a special arbitrariness complaint could be made there. On the other hand, it's very hard to think that Field's approach to nominalizing and constructing intrinsic laws based on standard sequences makes no arbitrary choices. So it seems difficult to me, it seems unlikely to me that a complaint of arbitrariness is really going to make a cut between laws like this, which talk about numbers, and intrinsic laws like Field's. So I said I was going to close on a kind of pessimistic note, and here's the pessimistic note, the pessimistic thought I have. The concern is that there's just no way around what Field's really reacting to in laws like this. What he's really reacting to there's a kind of artificiality to the way in which a constraint on the fundamental predicates is being concocted in either this sort of approach or else on the intrinsic approach that Field prefers. There's no escape from that kind of artificiality or arbitrariness or bringing in intuitively extraneous entities, because if we want a fundamental account that's very simple, has a very minimal basis, just a couple of fundamental properties and relations, it's bound to be that we've got to use all sorts of artificial-looking tricks to code up the kind of complex numerical statements we want to make when we state scientific laws. There's this concern that artificiality and arbitrariness and extraneousness is the inevitable result of choosing a minimal metaphysical basis for quantities. So I find that unsettling, not just because I found the desideratum of intrinsic laws correct and thought it could play a role as an important constraint on theorizing about quantity, but also because I worry about a challenge to the very intuitive simplicity-based epistemology for fundamentality. I mean, the intuitive basis for that epistemology is this. When you look at the laws as they really are, put on your fundamentality goggles and look at the laws as they are fundamentally, they ought to look good as laws. That's sort of you think that way, that's why you should expect, if you think the world ought to obey simple laws, that should mean simple laws when formulated in fundamental concepts, if you're thinking that that's the way the laws really are, fundamentally are, viewed as they're stated in terms of fundamental concepts. Well, the concern here is that the laws just don't look good as laws, viewed as they really are, because they look artificial. when you really look at what the laws are going to have to be like, what quantitative laws are going to have to look like when formulated in fundamental terms, if the fundamental basis is very sparse, the laws are going to have to look really artificial. What should we make of that? Should we think that some kinds of artificiality are bad and other kinds are good? Maybe we could reflect on the fact that Field's laws are highly non-local, spatially, and think that that's a reason to prefer a non-comparativist account of laws on which the laws wouldn't be so spatially non-local. That's a possibility. But in any case, I think that there's just a real hard question here for the friend of fundamentality, especially the friend of intrinsic laws. What sort of intrinsic laws are demanded, and can this idea that the laws ought to look good when viewed through the lens of fundamentality really be sustained?
Let me close with one final comment.
Changing gears completely. And so I've been focusing on the problem of quantity exclusively through the lens of fundamentality. I've been looking at the question of what the fundamental quantitative properties and relations are, and that led us to a search for intrinsic laws in those fundamental properties and led us to this pessimistic conclusion. So the most important recent defense of comparativism is by Shamik Dasgupta. And he approaches the problem completely different. He approaches the problem through the lens of ground rather than fundamentality. And so he formulates comparativism as the claim that as a group, the comparative relations, like being as or more massive, being twice as massive as, all these relations, ground absolute quantitative states, like that this has 5 grams mass. And he gets into lots of subtle questions about how that grounding might work. They're all very interesting. So he argues, for example, that individual statements about individual values of quantity, like this has 5 grams, grams mass, aren't grounded at all in relational terms. But nevertheless, as a group, holistically, the entire class of absolute mass statements are grounded collectively in the class of relational statements, comparativist statements. And those are all, so he does a lot of interesting work on these things. But he just doesn't get into any of the questions that we've been getting into because he doesn't focus on questions like which properties and relations of mass are fundamental, and so doesn't address the question of the nature of comparativist laws at all. So, I mean, my own point of view is that a proper account of fundamentality, of what reality is ultimately like, needs to get into these questions of what the fundamental properties and relations are. But in any case, we've got another illustration of the overall theme of these talks, which is that where you end up in first-order metaphysics, in this case the metaphysics of quantity, is highly sensitive to these more general metaphysical questions of whether the issue should be approached through the lens of ground or fundamentality or something else. Okay, thanks.